Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And first, we'll summarize some of the top stories of the past week. The big story today concerns a milestone in the exploration of outer space. Private enterprise, not taxpayers' money. Private enterprise sent the Falcon Heavy rocket into outer space. A moon rocket. A rocket that is the largest rocket on the planet Earth. The Falcon Heavy is capable of sending astronauts to the moon and then perhaps on to Mars. And some people think that we could be entering a new era. A golden age in space exploration after a 50-year gap. And then we're going to say a few things about medicine. It turns out that scientists at the University of Pennsylvania have created a memory chip, a chip that could be used for epileptics and people with Parkinson's disease to increase memory by 15%. And the question is, one day, will we have a memory chip where you simply push a button and memories come flooding into our brain? And then we'll say a few things about earthquakes. I'll be speaking in Berkeley in a few weeks on a book tour, and it turns out that there's a chance of a gigantic earthquake slicing Berkeley and Oakland in half, perhaps one in three. A 30% chance that perhaps we'll have a gigantic earthquake in the East Bay in the next 30 years. So we'll be talking about the potential of an earthquake. And as I mentioned before, I'll be on a book tour. I have a new book coming out called The Future of Humanity. About the future of the space program. What does it mean when we go back to the moon starting next year? That's right, December 2019. NASA expects to send the SLS booster rocket with the Orion space capsule to the moon, first in an unmanned launch, and then afterwards astronauts will return back to the moon. And then Elon Musk, riding on the tide of success from his Falcon Heavy rocket, well, he wants to go to Mars. That's right, he wants to go to Mars perhaps within 10, 15 years, using mainly private funding. And so we're witnessing perhaps a new age in the exploration of space. So first of all, I'll be traveling through New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, D.C., and many other cities. And perhaps I'll be signing your copy of The Future of Humanity. In New York City on February 19th, I'll be speaking at the Barnes & Noble on 82nd Street and Broadway. Write that down, February 19th. I'll be speaking right here in New York City at the Barnes & Noble at 7 o'clock on 82nd Street and Broadway. And then I'll be going out to the Bay Area. I'll be speaking in Berkeley, compliments of KPFA Radio. I'll be speaking in Berkeley on March 6th. I'll be speaking at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley. That's on 2345 Channing Way. So once again, that's on March 6th. I'll be speaking in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church as a guest of KPFA Radio. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The big story today is that Elon Musk, a billionaire, the driving force behind SpaceX, Tesla Motors, and PayPal, well, he created with his own funds a gigantic booster rocket, in fact, the biggest rocket on the planet Earth at the present time, the Falcon Heavy, and it had a successful launch. Now, the payload, of course, was a dummy payload because this was just a test, and he put his own Tesla Roadster inside the rocket, and so now for the first time in history, we have a sports car that is in orbit. And who knows, maybe sometimes millions of years in the future, aliens from outer space will intercept it and see what Earthlings used to drive on the highway. So it is a milestone in the history of space exploration because it means that costs are going down. In 1966, the cost of NASA was enormous at the height of the Cold War and the height of the space race. It turns out that the NASA budget in 1966 was about 5% of the federal budget. Now, that is unsustainable. And of course, in the 1970s, funding for NASA collapsed. And that was the end of the moon program. But now we have several factors coming into play. But the economics of space travel have been changing dramatically. Recently, just a few years ago, the Indians sent a probe to Mars on the first try. This is the first time it's happened that a developing nation has been able to send a probe to the planet Mars on the first try. And the Chinese, not to be outdone, have laid out a program to put a space station in space and then plant the Chinese flag on the moon. NASA, of course, is not too far behind. NASA not just wants to go to the moon, but to create a lunar orbiter. That's right. NASA wants to create a lunar orbiter like the space station that'll give us a permanent presence in outer space. From that lunar orbiter, NASA wants to create a Mars ship. That's right, a gigantic rocket using ion engines that'll take four astronauts all the way to the planet Mars. When? Well, first of all, starting next year, December 2019, NASA wants to send an unmanned probe around the moon as a practice mission. In 2022, NASA wants to send astronauts back to the moon after a 50-year gap. And then sometime in the mid-2030s, NASA wants to go on to Mars. Of course, Elon Musk, using private funds, has his own time frame. He also hopes to get some NASA money for a Mars ship that perhaps will reach Mars maybe 10 years before NASA does. And so we may have a traffic jam. Eventually, we may have a traffic jam over Mars, given the fact that Silicon Valley billionaires have their own timetable. And speaking about Silicon Valley billionaires, Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, well, he's created his own rocket base in Texas. That's right. He was too impatient to wait for rockets to be launched from Cape Canaveral, so he created his own launch pad in Texas and his own rockets. He has a fleet of rockets that, first of all, will take tourists into outer space and then into orbit, and finally on to the moon. And he also has a vision of the future. For Elon Musk, he wants to create a multi-planet species. He says it is simply too dangerous to put life on one planet. We need an insurance policy. We need to make sure that humanity can survive even if there's a catastrophe that hits the planet Earth. That's the vision given to us by Elon Musk, a vision that, of course, comes to us from many science fiction writers like Isaac Asimov and scientists like Carl Sagan. However, Jeff Bezos has a different vision. His vision is, when you look at all the polluting plants on the planet Earth, well, why not put them in outer space? Why not take all the heavy machinery and all the pollution, put them in outer space, and make the Earth into a park? So this, for the same reason that in cities, we try to concentrate the industrial areas in one place and we try to make the center of the city into a park, why not make the Earth into a park? Already, Jeff Bezos has stated that he wants to create a delivery system to the moon. Just like Amazon.com can deliver products right to your doorstep, he wants to create a similar system that'll take hardware between the Earth and the moon. Well, the next step, as I mentioned before, is the planet Mars. Now, it's not going to be an easy journey. It only took 3 days. That's a hop, skip, and a jump. 3 days to go from the Earth to the moon. However, it's going to take 2 years to go to the planet Mars. And so we're talking about a major commitment of funds, a major commitment of space hardware to go to Mars. First, it'll take about 9 months to reach the red planet. And once we're on Mars, we have to do experiments and wait for the stars to line up for the return journey. And then we come back with another 9-month journey. And when you add up all the months in space, it turns out it's about 2 years. Now, that's an awful long time, given the fact that the world's record for being in orbit continuously is just a little bit over 1 year. And that was set by Commander Polyakov of Russia. And when he came back to the Earth after 1 year of weightlessness, he could barely crawl like a bug. There was so much atrophy of his muscles that he couldn't even walk when he got out of the space capsule. That means that our Martian astronauts are going to have to exercise all the time. Now, what do we do when we get there? We're talking about perhaps a permanent presence on Mars. First of all, there are lava tubes on Mars that are naturally forming, caves formed by ancient volcanoes. And they could be used as a basis for a Mars base. Because Mars is, well, it's radioactive. There's a lot of radiation from the sun and cosmic rays from outer space, and we have to shield our astronauts from the hazards of radiation. We should also point out that it's very cold on Mars, and the atmosphere is very thin. The atmosphere is only 1% the atmospheric pressure found on the planet Earth, and you can't breathe that atmosphere because it's carbon dioxide. So the next big step would be the terraforming of Mars. That is, taking Mars as a frozen desert, injecting, for example, methane gas to speed up a greenhouse effect to heat up Mars, and then perhaps have gigantic solar mirrors to melt the polar ice caps. This, of course, is science fiction, and it may take decades before we can do this, but it does mean that at some point we may be able to have a self-sustaining colony on Mars. For example, algae and plants. You can genetically modify algae and plants so they can thrive in the Martian atmosphere. Plants, of course, love carbon dioxide. They would have to be genetically modified so they can live in the very cold atmosphere of Mars. And then it may be possible to create self-sustaining agriculture, that is, plants and food stocks that are grown indigenously on the red planet. Well, what about the pros and cons? What about the costs? What about the dangers? What about the benefits of all this? Find out more by getting a copy of my latest book, The Future of Humanity, which gets into the pros and cons of the space program and the vision given to us by these space-age pioneers who are opening up their checkbooks in order to explore outer space. Also, speaking about the Earth and Mars, we should say something about earthquakes. That's right. It seems that recently we've had a series of earthquakes in Japan, in the Philippines, in Taiwan. And some people say, is there a link between all these different earthquakes? Well, yes and no. They're all part of the Pacific Ring of Fire, which extends from Chile up to the coast of Mexico, through California, up to Alaska, into Japan, down into the Philippines. And when you get a chart and you map all these different earthquakes, you find that most of them lie along the Pacific Ring of Fire. Now, is there a link between them? Probably not, because this Pacific Ring of Fire, in turn, consists of many short segments, fault lines, and one fault line does not necessarily trigger another fault line. But hey, we're still children when it comes to understanding the dynamics of earthquakes and whether or not one earthquake could, in principle, set off another. At the present time, the consensus is probably no, but who knows? Time will tell. Well, here's a new news story coming from Berkeley, where I'm going to be next month on a book tour. It turns out that the Hayward Fault goes right underneath the football stadium. In fact, I used to go there often when I was a PhD student at Berkeley years ago, and the stadium is slowly being ripped apart. That's right. The stadium sits on top of a fault line, and the Berkeley Stadium is, in fact, being slowly ripped apart. Well, here's a new study that came out just a few days ago. The probability of a major earthquake along the Hayward Fault is 1 in 3 over a 30-year period, which means that within the lifetime of many of the people listening to this radio program, we're going to see major catastrophes in California. First of all, we should point out that perhaps the weakest link in the whole chain is the San Andreas Fault north of San Francisco. That is one of the weakest links in the chain. But of course, we have the San Andreas Fault that goes right through the Bay Area, and an offshoot, the Hayward Fault, that goes underneath the University of California at Berkeley, where I got my PhD so many years ago. So now we can begin to calculate the chances of these earthquakes. We're getting better at this. However, it's still black magic trying to predict when the big one will take place. But the consensus that I get by talking to seismologists and by reading their studies is that we are overdue. That's right. We are overdue for another big one. Not just one, but perhaps several. So in other words, a word to the wise, in the lifetime of many of the people listening to this radio show, you may see the big one. You may see parts of Los Angeles, parts of San Francisco in the Bay Area, parts of Berkeley ripped apart by an earthquake exceeding 7.0 on the Richter scale. For example, the Hayward Fault last sustained a major earthquake in 1868. And so memories are short. We have no memories of these gigantic earthquakes that took place in the 1800s, and we've been lulled to sleep because we only had the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, but hardly another big one on that scale. But it's inevitable. It's inevitable that we're going to have not one, but perhaps several big ones in California. Think about that. Also on the medical front, the United States military is very much concerned about the health of our GIs coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, many of whom have sustained brain injuries and injuries to the spinal cord. And so what the military wants is a memory chip. In fact, the military has allocated about $70 million to fund research in a memory chip. Now, progress, of course, is very slow because the memory of the human brain is not necessarily digital. We can interface very easily with digital systems that are based on zeros and ones, zeros and ones. However, neurons are much more complicated. They are not digital in the sense of only being zeros and ones. They form a network, a gigantic neural network, and it doesn't compute like an ordinary computer. It learns. Our brain is a learning machine, not a computing machine, and that's why it's so difficult to interface computers with the human brain. For example, the human brain has no operating system. The human brain has no Windows. It has no Pentium chip. It has no CPU. It has no subroutines. In fact, the brain doesn't have anything that you normally find in a digital computer. So what is the brain? The brain is a neural network. That is, it's a mass of neurons that learn tediously after every task. It goes back to that old expression, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? The answer, practice, practice, practice. That's how the brain learns, by repetition. It gets better after each iteration, and that's what the brain does in a spectacular way that digital computers cannot. In other words, digital computers are just as stupid today as they were yesterday. Let's do an experiment. Try to teach your laptop something new. And you begin to realize that laptops are not designed to be learning machines. They're not designed to rewire themselves after every task. But that's exactly what the human brain does. And then the question is, how do you interface between the human brain and a digital computer? Well, as I reported in my book, The Future of the Mind, one way to do it is to put a chip right on top of the brain. And then by trial and error, try to associate the blips that we get coming from the human brain and correlate them with activities. And so to create a dictionary, painfully, to create a dictionary between different kinds of motions and impulses that we detect in the brain and the motion of, for example, a mechanical arm or a mechanical leg, so that the human brain can then begin to coordinate the motion of a mechanical leg or mechanical arm. It's very tedious, but exoskeletons have been made. We had a guest on Exploration, Miguel Nicolilis of Duke University, who made history by taking a paraplegic who was paralyzed, wiring him up to an exoskeleton so that he could kick the football, initiating the San Paulo soccer games. That's right, a billion people saw a paralyzed man hooked up to a machine, an exoskeleton, by which he was able to kick the football. Well, just last week, there's been a new announcement from the University of Pennsylvania concerning another type of memory chip. This memory chip was used on epileptics. Now, epilepsy is one disease that, in part, is caused when the left brain and the right brain are out of whack. We have two lobes in the brain, left and the right lobe. Each one does slightly different tasks, but they talk to each other. But sometimes the impulses between the left and the right lobe get out of control. They have a spasm of activity, and then you go into convulsions as a consequence. And so what these scientists did was they tried to track and understand these impulses that get out of control and try to regulate them so that you don't necessarily have to have these spasms of neural activity when the left lobe and the right lobe interact with each other to the point of chaos, and then you undergo spasms and convulsions. Well, the progress is rather encouraging. With a 15% increase in memory, they were able to say that, yes, they were able to score for the first time in medical history an improvement in memory coming from a chip. Now, of course, we have a long ways to go before this becomes a practical device. Don't expect to be able to push a button and understand calculus or take a vacation to Hawaii just by sitting in your chair. It doesn't work that way. However, it does show that we're making progress. For the first time, we're making progress in interfacing the brain with a computer. And like I said, if you want to know more about this, get a copy of my earlier book, The Future of the Mind, where I talk about all the developments that we've made concerning being able to understand the origin of mental illness, the origin of consciousness, because we can now begin the process of interfacing the brain with a computer. For example, one question that I often get in emails is about mental illness. With all this activity concerning understanding the brain using electronics, what about things like schizophrenia? Well, schizophrenia affects about 1% of the human race. That is, we're talking about one of the greatest afflictions of people in the United States or anywhere on the planet Earth is mental illness, where we have people that hear voices. Now, when you hear voices, basically your left brain is generating these voices, but you are aware of it. You sit right behind your prefrontal cortex, that is, behind your forehead. So the front part of your brain, the conscious brain, is aware of the fact that the left part of the brain is generating voices. In fact, you're generating voices right now. If you're listening to my voice, you're probably saying to yourself, is that right? Huh, I didn't know that. And so the left brain is already generating voices as you process this radio program. Now, when you do the same thing for schizophrenics, you find that they have episodes where voices emanate from the brain, the left brain, but you are unaware of it. You have no control over it. In other words, the front brain does not talk to the left brain. There is a defect in the communication between the conscious brain behind your forehead and the left brain, which generates voices. And that's the reason why schizophrenics hear voices. Now, think about that for a moment. If one day you were to all of a sudden hear voices without your permission, you think you're going mad. You think you're crazy, right? Well, that's what madness is. Apparently, one form of madness is when the front brain does not talk to the left brain. Now, that doesn't mean we can cure it. Oh, no, we can't cure it yet. But it does mean that we're beginning to understand the mechanisms behind things like mental illness. And that is a tremendous victory for science. Also, there's more news on the medical front, and turns out scientists just this week verified the fact that there is a new test for people that may eventually get Alzheimer's disease. Now, it's a very sad statement, but Alzheimer's disease could be the disease of the century. As baby boomers age, we're talking about an enormous fraction of the population of the world, in fact, that could eventually come down with different forms of dementia. In fact, by the time you're in your mid-80s, about 50% of healthy people come down with Alzheimer's disease. That's how common this affliction is, which robs you of your most precious commodity, and that is the memory of who you are and who your loved ones are. Well, it turns out that the only way to make sure that a person had Alzheimer's is, well, to do an autopsy. However, there are now breakthroughs being made as we slowly tease apart some of the mystery behind Alzheimer's. First of all, Alzheimer's is typified by a gum called amyloid protein that gums up the brain. We don't know whether this gum causes Alzheimer's disease or is a byproduct of Alzheimer's disease. But sure enough, when you do autopsies, you see that the brain is full of this gum called amyloid protein, which does hinder the functioning of neurons. Now, recently, it turns out that with MRI scans, we can begin to see the early stages of the formation of these protein plaques in the brain. But here's a new result that was just announced this week. And that is, by using a mass spectrograph, by analyzing the blood of an individual, you can begin to see large quantities of amyloid protein being built up in the person's blood. Now, this could be a painless, simple way in which to begin the process of seeing who will eventually get Alzheimer's disease. Well, as I said before, I'll be on a book tour starting in the end of February and going into early March. In New York City, on February 19th, I'll be speaking at the Barnes & Noble on 82nd Street and Broadway. And on March 6th, I'll be in Berkeley, compliments of KPFA Radio, a Pacifica station, which also carries Exploration. So once again, if you want to know where I'll be traveling, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, or go to my Facebook site. In fact, I'm very proud to say that on Facebook, we now have over 3 million fans on Facebook, over 600,000 fans on Twitter. And if you want to find out what all the excitement is about, then perhaps go to my book tour and maybe I'll be signing your copy of The Future of Humanity. And after that, you can go to eBay and auction it off for money. That's right, you could probably make money on my book tour. And so once again, go to my Facebook site or go to my website, mkaku.org, to find out what all the excitement is about. Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Now, in the second part of Exploration, we're going to bring on Robert Zubrin, co-founder of the Mars Society. And some people think of him as a visionary in the sense that for decades he's talked about going to Mars when most people wouldn't listen at all. But now that prices have dropped, now that Silicon Valley billionaires are subsidizing many of these space missions, and the space program is much more efficient and cost-conscious than it was back in the 1960s. Some people are saying now is the time to go into outer space because costs have dropped, things are safer, and it could create a new industry, a high-tech industry in outer space that'll create jobs, economic activity, and perhaps a multi-planet species. So stay tuned for the next segment of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In this segment of Exploration, we're going to talk about the planet Mars. Now, of course, the planet Mars has been like a magnet for science fiction writers and visionaries ever since the 1800s, when scientists began to take a good look at the red planet. In fact, it was in the last century that Edgar Rice Burroughs began to fantasize about heroes and princesses on Mars with his John Carter of Mars series, along, of course, with his earlier Tarzan series. And it turns out that an astronomer, Percival Lowell, started the stampede to look at the planet Mars by claiming that there was evidence of life on Mars, that canals on Mars represented the last-ditch effort of a dying civilization to irrigate the planet that was gradually becoming a desert. Well, now we have detailed photographs of the planet Mars. In fact, we know more about the surface of Mars than we do about the surface of the planet Earth, because most of the Earth's surface is covered in water. First of all, there are no canals. We know that because we have detailed photographs of Mars, no canals, no sign of intelligent life. In fact, no sign of life at all on the planet Mars. So if Mars is a desolate, frozen desert with no evidence of life at all, then why even bother to think about trying to colonize Mars? Well, Carl Sagan, who I interviewed for Exploration, said that in the long term, we have to become a two-planet species. That is, it's simply too dangerous to put life just on one planet. Of course, there's no rush. We don't have to have a crash program to do that. But there's no particular rush. But at some point, we will have to leave the planet Earth. On a scale of thousands of years, we have to worry about a new ice age. We have to worry about volcanic eruptions. We have to worry about meteor impact craters. We have to worry about a gigantic planet-killing, life-killing asteroid or comet that could hit the Earth on a scale of 50 million years. And then on a scale of 5 billion years, the sun will eat up the Earth whole. We came from the sun, and we will go back into the sun. The Bible says, from dust to dust, ashes to ashes. Scientists say, from stardust we came, and to stardust we will go back. And it means that at some point, we will have to either leave the Earth or die. That's a law of physics. And so some people say, well, let's begin the process of now. Other people say, well, what's the big rush? Well, one possibility to go to Mars is real because of the fact that the cost of going to Mars has dropped drastically down in the last several decades. I remember when George Bush the First talked about going to Mars by 2020. That was his target to go to Mars. But the estimates were $200 to $500 billion. And that's back then. You can imagine what it would cost today with those dollars, perhaps $1 trillion to go to Mars. Well, since then, we've learned a few tricks. Since then, SpaceX is pioneering things like the reusable rocket to bring down the cost. And now instead of $200 billion, people are saying, well, maybe $10 billion. We can begin the process of a manned, piloted mission to the Red Planet. Well, with us here today is someone who's done the math, someone who's done the pioneering work, a founder of the Mars Society, Dr. Robert Zubrin, a former aerospace engineer. And we're going to ask him what his opinion is about going to Mars and what we're going to do once we get there. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're delighted to have with us Dr. Robert Zubrin. He's an aerospace engineer and author of several books, including The Case for Mars and Mars on Earth. That's right, we're talking about President George W. Bush's Mars Initiative, and the question is, should we send humans to the planet Mars? Some people say it's too dangerous, it's too expensive, and there are other priorities. Other people say, let's go for it. So once again, our special guest today is Dr. Robert Zubrin, author of the book Case for Mars, founder of the Mars Society, and we are talking about whether or not we should put humans on the Red Planet. The first question for you, Dr. Zubrin, is how did you first get interested in science?
Well, actually, it was Sputnik. I was 5 years old at the time, and I was already reading science fiction. And while to the adult world, Sputnik was a terrifying event, or so I'm told, to me anyway, it was exhilarating, because what it meant was that all these stories I was reading about the spacefaring future were going to become real. And I wanted to be part of it. And so I dug into every science book I could find. And, you know, my father got me a telescope when I was 7. And, you know, Kennedy gave his speech committing us to the moon when I was 9. And, you know, during my teen years, we were moving out. We landed on the moon when I was 17. And there was a great adventure underway, and I wanted to be part of that. I think if we were to have a Humans to Mars program today, it would encourage millions of people today to want to enter science.
And I understand you were an aerospace engineer for a while. Could you elaborate? And then how did you go about finding the Mars Society?
Well, I still am an aerospace engineer. That's what I do for a living. I used to work for Martin Marietta and then Lockheed Martin, and then I founded my own company, Pioneer Astronautics, which does technology research and development on contract for NASA and the Air Force. And that's how my source of income. That's my professional preoccupation. I don't get any money from the Mars Society. But the Mars Society was founded by me and a number of other people who for a long time had believed that the American space program needs a goal, and humans to Mars should be that goal, both for scientific reasons and for inspirational reasons and for societal reasons. You know, I wrote a book called The Case for Mars in 1996. I got 4,000 letters from people who read it from all over the world asking me all kinds of things, but basically asking, how do we make this happen? And when I showed this to the other folks in what was then called the Mars Underground, we decided the time had come to pull all this talent together and form an organization so that there would be a force in being that could actually try to make humans to Mars happen.
Okay, well, let's talk about Mars as a planet and also Mars from science fiction. If you read all science fiction novels, they do say that Mars is a desert, but they said that this is a desert populated by Tharks and Martians and all sorts of different denizens and aliens. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the geology and atmosphere of Mars.
Okay, well, Mars is a desert today, although as we're now learning, it wasn't always so. It's a frozen desert. It's a polar desert, like what we have in the Canadian Arctic. And in fact, the Mars Society has built a Mars station in the Canadian Arctic to learn how to explore these kinds of environments. It's unlikely that there's life on the Martian surface today, but we can identify places on Mars. And of course, the news this week is that we have identified for sure places on the surface of Mars that were once warm and wet and that could have supported life. And that makes Mars really the Rosetta Stone for letting us know whether the conjecture that life originates as a natural development of complexity from chemistry wherever it has an acceptable environment, whether that is true or not. If that's true, then life is plentiful in the universe. If it's not true, if there's an element of miraculous chance involved in forming these DNAs and RNAs and all these other very complex molecules, then we could be alone. And Mars is the critical test that's going to let us find out. By looking for fossils on the surface of Mars, and by drilling down into the ground and reaching groundwater where there might still be extant Martian life today.
Okay, well, for those people who saw Arnold Schwarzenegger in the movie Total Recall, they know a little bit about Martian ecology. It's very cold up there, and the atmosphere is very thin.
Yeah.
And so the question is, what would it take for an astronaut to live on Mars, given the fact that it's cold, the atmosphere is like 1% of the atmospheric pressure of the Earth, and there are huge sandstorms on Mars. So tell us a little bit about what it would like to live on Mars.
Okay. Well, as you point out, the atmospheric pressure on Mars is much too low to allow an unprotected human to walk around on the Martian surface today. So you would have to wear a spacesuit when you went outside. When you're inside, you could be inside of your habitat modules, which are like big tuna cans with life support systems in them, and you would live in them in a shirt-sleeve environment. The temperature extremes on Mars are worse than the Earth, but much less bad than the Moon. Actually, on Mars, in the middle of the day, it gets to about 50 Fahrenheit. At night, it might go down to minus 130, so probably be a good idea to stay inside at night. The dust storms on Mars occur periodically, but actually, because the Martian air is so thin, high winds up to 100 miles an hour don't have that much dynamic pressure. The 100-mile-an-hour wind on Mars has about the same force as a 10-mile-an-hour wind on Earth. So they're not really a threat, except if they're happening while you're landing, and then you have a big parachute out, which could be seized by such winds. But if you're on the ground, you could weather them quite easily, and the Viking landers weathered many dust storms without any difficulty at all.
And I understand the gravity is weaker, and the day is about similar to a day on the Earth. So tell us a little bit about what it would be like in terms of the day, the seasons, and the gravity on Mars.
Well, the gravity on Mars is 38% that of Earth. So if you weighed, 100 pounds, you'd weigh 38 pounds on Mars. So that's an advantage. It means that if you're walking around with a big, heavy spacesuit, let's say you weighed 150 pounds and your spacesuit weighs 200 pounds on Earth, you wouldn't be able to walk around in that on Earth. But on Mars, okay, the total mass is 350 pounds, and it would only feel like about 110 pounds. So you would actually feel lighter on Mars, even wearing that spacesuit, than you would if you were on Earth naked. So that's an advantage. The day is 24 hours, 37 minutes long. So it's really just like an Earth day. People can adapt to that quite easily. And it's all one of the things that make Mars attractive for settlement, because you could grow plants in greenhouses lit by natural sunlight, since the diurnal cycle of light and dark would be very similar to Earth. This is, for instance, not the case on the Moon, where you have 14 days of light and 14 days of dark at a time, which is unacceptable to most plants.
Okay, and also tell us a little bit about the water. You said that Mars once upon a time had flowing rivers and perhaps even an ocean, mm-hmm. but what happened?
Well, it's not completely clear what happened, but the dominant theory is as follows. Okay, that Mars in its early history was warm and wet because it had a thick CO2 atmosphere, which made a very strong greenhouse effect on the planet. You know, people are talking about global warming on the Earth due to CO2 emissions from industry. Well, and that can warm a planet because CO2 traps heat. On Mars, you had a much thicker CO2 atmosphere, so much so that even though the planet was farther away from the sun than the Earth, it was still warm enough for liquid water. So a greenhouse effect, bad on Earth, but good on Mars. Now, the problem, though, with Mars is that the planet is too small for plate tectonics. And the reason why this is an issue is the following, that when you have rain, as you did in the early Mars, and you do on Earth, of course, CO2 dissolves readily in water. It gets taken down by the rainwater into the ground, where it reacts readily with rocks to form carbonates. Now, on Earth, those carbonates are recycled back into the atmosphere through the motion of the geology, through plate tectonics that melts all rocks on timescales of around 100 million years and returns the CO2 back into the biosphere. On Mars, once the stuff gets locked up as carbonates, it's pretty much locked up. So the CO2 atmosphere on Mars started to thin out over time. Now, as it thinned out over time, Mars started to cool because the greenhouse effect got weaker. And when it reaches a certain low temperature, then soil has the capacity to sponge in CO2. Adsorption is what it's called. And once adsorption begins, that thins out the atmosphere much more rapidly than carbonate formation, and you get a runaway icebox effect, where the more CO2 is absorbed, the colder it gets, the more is absorbed, and wham, the whole planet freezes up. And it's been in deep freeze now for perhaps 3 billion years.
Dr. Zubrin, some scientists have said that there's a potential of creating an artificial greenhouse effect on the red planet, which would then raise the temperatures on Mars. Could you elaborate?
Now, someday, human settlers on Mars, when there's enough of them and they have enough industrial capability, could conceivably set up factories on Mars for producing artificial greenhouse gases like fluorocarbons. You don't want to do chlorofluorocarbons because they destroy ozone, but fluorocarbons don't destroy ozone, but they're very powerful greenhouse gases. And if you produce them and you warm the planet up around 10 degrees C through your own efforts, that would warm the planet enough that CO2 would outgas out of the soil and start adding to your greenhouse effect. And we could raise the planet by 50 degrees centigrade. We could create a Mars whose tropical regions were tropical. and in which there's liquid water on the surface again. And while you couldn't breathe that atmosphere because it'd be almost all CO2, plants could. And you could put plants on the ground outside. There'd be rain. There'd be water cycling, and you could start to green Mars. It'd be a tremendous accomplishment of positive environmental engineering.
Okay. Well, also, tell us what about the ice caps of Mars. Some people think that some of the water snowed on the ice caps. Other people think that the water is still there underground in the permafrost. Could you elaborate?
Yes. Well, there is water on Mars, and almost undoubtedly in both of those locations. We can see the northern polar ice cap on Mars is water ice. And it looks like people thought the southern ice cap might have been mostly CO2 ice, but measurements that we've taken from our orbiters indicate that it's at least 60% water ice as well, and possibly all water ice. And then we can see geologic features that look like water bursting out of the sides of craters in the geologically recent period, which means there has to be subsurface aquifers of liquid water that occasionally break loose. So that's one reason why you really want to send human explorers to Mars, because if we're going to find life on Mars, actual living organisms, not just fossils, we're going to have to set up drilling rigs and reach that groundwater. Then you want to take that water into your habitat on Mars, throw it into bacterial culture medium, see if anything grows. If it does, image it in your microscopes, test it with biochemical testing. See what it's like. See if it mimics the biochemistry of Earth life or if it's something different. This is something we really want to know. We really want to know if all life as it is in the universe is the same as Earth life, since all Earth life is biochemically the same. We all use the same amino acids and the same RNA and DNA method of transmitting information. Or are there other methods of creating life? One of the fundamental questions in science today, and the way we're going to resolve it is by going to Mars.
Well, we don't see any liquid water on Mars today, but some people think that perhaps there could be underground geysers or underground hot springs due to volcanic activity, in which case there could be pockets of liquid water even today. But what are your thoughts?
Well, as I said, the geomorphological evidence is that there is underground liquid water on Mars today. Because the Mars Global Surveyor orbiter took pictures from orbit that showed channels that had been cut out from the sides of craters from water bursting out from the sides. And these things are totally uncratered themselves, which means they happened in the past few million years, which is basically, from the geological point of view, today. So if water could burst out of the side of a crater 4 million years ago, it could do it tomorrow. And that means there has to be liquid water underground on Mars now.
Okay, now let's talk about the robotic exploration of Mars. Some scientists have called Mars the death planet because so many Mars missions have failed. However, we now have rovers on the surface of Mars looking at rock formations. What have they found specifically that has excited the imagination of scientists, the two rovers on Mars?
Okay, well, let me just point out that 12 out of 16 American spacecraft sent to Mars have succeeded. Okay, 4 out of 5 of our landers have succeeded. The reason why the Mars statistics are so low is because the Russians sent 14 spacecraft to Mars and all of theirs failed. But in terms of our own record with regard to Mars, we're batting around 700. Now, what have we found? Okay, well, from orbit, we have found water erosion features all over the place, dry riverbeds, dry lake beds, what looks like perhaps the basin of a dried-up northern ocean. On the ground, what we just found this week is that these water features were not created by water that was just there in some flash floods that lasted an afternoon and then the water was gone, which is what some people had been suggesting. But rather, this water was there for a long period of time. We found what the Opportunity rover has found are what's called evaporites, that is, residues left when water evaporates and the salts in the water and the sulfates in the water have been left behind. This requires standing bodies of water that exist for long periods of time and stay in place long enough for the water to evaporate away. And what's very conclusive, what we've learned from these robots, is there have been places on Mars where life could have developed. And now the key question is, did it?
Okay, now let's talk about the practical implications of sending men to Mars, as advocated by President George W. Bush. First of all, let me play devil's advocate. Let's talk about cost. We know we could do it. We just put enough money into it, throw money at it, and we could put men on Mars. George Bush Sr., when he proposed a manned mission to Mars, numbers that were being thrown out were on the order of $500 billion. What do you think it would cost under your program to put men on Mars?
I think we could have people on Mars within 10 years for $40 to $50 billion. The issue here is actually constraining the problem in the way President Kennedy did with Apollo, where you put a timeline on it and you say, you've got to do this within a decade. And so you don't just launch a plethora of programs and say, well, you know, this might be useful for someday in the future when people go to the moon or to Mars, and this might be useful. Instead, you sit down, you design an end-to-end plan for how to do it, you design a coherent set of hardware elements to implement that plan, you develop those hardware elements and the associated technologies and no others, you build them, and you fly the mission. If you do that, you can be on Mars in a decade. If you don't do that, you can spend any amount of money you like, and you can spend decade after decade, and you'll have no progress at all. And this is the difference between the NASA of the Apollo period, of the basically from 61 to 73, and the NASA of the three decades since. It may startle people to learn that NASA's budget this year is something like 94% of what its average budget was during the Apollo period in real inflation-adjusted dollars. That is, the average Apollo period budget in today's money was $17 billion a year. NASA's budget this year is $16 billion. And we've spent as much money in NASA between 1990 and today as we did between 61 and 73. But in that earlier period, we developed all the space technologies we have and that we use, and we sent people to the moon, and we sent 40 lunar and planetary probes out. In the period between 1990 and today, we developed no new space technologies. We did not fly anyone to the moon or anywhere like that, and we flew maybe, what, 7 or 8 planetary probes. So when you actually have a goal and you force the organization to address that goal rather than use that goal as a rationale for doing whatever it pleases to do, except for the goal, you can really accomplish something.
Okay. Now, one of your plans, which is controversial, is to give our astronauts a one-way ticket to Mars, have them develop rocket fuel themselves for the return trip. So tell us a little bit about how that is done in order to reduce costs.
Okay. This is known as the Mars Direct Plan, and it's explained at length in my book, The Case for Mars. The way this works is you do this mission with two launches of a heavy lift launch vehicle of equal capability to the Saturn V moon rockets that we used in the 60s. The first rocket shoots to Mars an Earth return vehicle with no one in it. Now that goes out and that lands on Mars. Then you run a pump and you suck in the Martian air, which is mostly carbon dioxide gas. You react that carbon dioxide with a small amount of hydrogen that you brought from Earth to produce a large supply of methane oxygen rocket propellant. So now you have a fully fueled Earth return vehicle sitting waiting for you on the surface of Mars. Once that is done, then you launch the crew out to Mars with the second rocket. Okay? Now, because the return ride is waiting for them on the surface of Mars, they don't need to fly to Mars in a gigantic Battlestar Galactica spaceship that nobody knows how to build. Okay? They can just fly to Mars in a basic habitation module, like a big tuna can, flies out to Mars. It takes 6 months to get to Mars with chemical propulsion. We do not need nuclear propulsion to get to Mars in 6 months. Mars Odyssey did it in 2001. In 6 months, we can get there right now with this. We go to Mars. We land near the Earth return vehicle. We use the same habitat that we used as our ship to go to Mars to be our house on Mars for a year and a half while we explore the planet. And then at the end of that time, we get in the Earth return vehicle and we fly back to Earth. We leave the habitat behind on Mars. So each time you do this, you add another habitat to the base. And before long, you've built up the beginning of the first human settlement on a new world. There is nothing in this that is beyond our technology, and I might add that the risk associated with this plan is much lower than that of the conventional mission, because the conventional mission involves extremely complex on-orbit assembly of mega spacecraft, which has much lower quality control than you can ever have on the ground at the Cape integrating the much smaller spacecraft that are required for this mission. And furthermore, the return vehicle has already been landed on Mars before you leave Earth, and that's actually safer than the conventional mission in which you attempt to land on Mars in the vehicle that you hope to take off from. In other words, here you know before you've even left Earth that you already have an ascent vehicle that has survived the trauma of landing on Mars. In the other mission plan, you don't. So this plan is doable with our technology. It's much less costly than the standard plan. It's much less risky than the standard plan. It accomplishes a lot more science than the standard plan because all the crew is on Mars. No one is left in orbit. We've got the technology to do it. So all it takes is some vision, some guts, and a little bit of moxie.
Okay. Well, I was watching CNN television the other day, and the commentator said, well, the Mars rover is going on Mars, but what did it find? Rocks. Rocks, rocks, and more rocks. And what he was implying, therefore, is that there's really not a pot of gold out there. There's really no reason to spend any more money on the mission to Mars. So let me ask you a question. What are the economic benefits? Why go to Mars if it's an enormous amount of money for a goal that is a little bit dubious?
Well, the goal is not dubious at all. And saying there's nothing on Mars but rocks is like saying in 1600 there's nothing in North America but trees and animals. I mean, it's an extremely anti-intellectual and stupid statement. What there is on Mars is a world. It is a planet with a surface area equal to all the continents of the Earth put together. And it has on it all the resources needed to support life and therefore potentially human civilization. And if we can go to Mars and develop the technology that allow human beings to be self-sufficient in this environment, as you know, previous generations of our ancestors, starting from those who left Africa to take on Ice Age Europe, did, human beings have used their creativity to master environments that were previously considered uninhabitable.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration and our interview with Dr. Robert Zubrin. And if you want more about space, go to my book tour. On February 19th, I'll be speaking at the Barnes & Noble on 82nd Street and Broadway in Manhattan. And on March 6th, I'll be speaking in Berkeley, compliments of KPFA Radio, at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley. And if you want my complete schedule, then go to my website. It's mkaku.org, mkaku.org, and find out what all the excitement is about, the promise, the perils, the costs, the pluses and minuses of exploring the universe.